Hey, this is Michael O'Keefe. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest and China Lake. Radio powered by the people.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, and happy International Women's Day. Less than 2 weeks ago, I moderated a webinar marking the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The webinar was sponsored by Haymarket Books and the Ukraine Solidarity Network, and it brought together Denis Pilash from Kyiv, Russian exile Grusha Gilayeva, and Howie Hawkins from the U.S.-Ukraine Solidarity Network, who spent time in Ukraine this year. Just days after this discussion, the Trump administration laid out its vision for peace, a deal that trades an end to the fighting in exchange for U.S. economic control over Ukraine's critical minerals without providing security guarantees. This is no peace plan, but a surrender, a betrayal of Ukraine's fight for self-determination. Our guests, Denis Pilash, Grusha Gilayeva, and Howie Hawkins, unpack Trump's blackmail, the dire consequences of a Putin-Trump axis, what's at stake for Ukraine, and what it will mean for the Russian left and Putin's political prisoners. Stay tuned for Ukraine's fight for self-determination, 3 years of resistance against Russian imperialism, when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today, we bring you a special webinar I moderated on the third anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It was called Ukraine's Fight for Self-Determination, 3 Years of Resistance Against Russian Imperialism. The discussion took place just before Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was deliberately humiliated in a televised White House spectacle, Trump mocking his attire, Vance demanding his gratitude, and Ukraine itself being thrown under the bus. The so-called peace deal Trump proposed was less a negotiation than a shakedown, a ceasefire in exchange for U.S. control over Ukraine's critical minerals, terms already hashed out in a U.S.-Russia meeting in Saudi Arabia, where Ukraine had no seat at the table. So what does this moment signify? The truth is straightforward. Trump has switched sides, and history has taken a darker turn. Trump's mafia-style posturing with sycophantic Vance, ever his eager enforcer, can't obscure what's really at play. Trump really admires Putin and despises democracy in Ukraine and beyond. But beyond the insults, what real damage can he do? He's already pledged to cut off U.S. military aid to Ukraine, a move he telegraphed before the election. While European nations are stepping up their military support, the U.S. shift is a major blow. Trump could also attempt to lift sanctions on Putin and Kremlin oligarchs, defying the 2017 Sanctions Act, which requires congressional approval. Given his history, there's little doubt Trump would try to bulldoze right through legal barriers. But even if sanctions are canceled, they have not been very effective as a tool to stop Putin. Meanwhile, Putin, buoyed by Trump's outburst against Zelensky, continues his war of attrition, sending wave after wave of young men to die in the scorched earth of eastern Ukraine. The Russian economy, battered but functional, isn't close to collapse. And while Ukraine is strained and exhausted, relying on conscripts now to sustain the fight, Putin is far from achieving military victory. His ultimate goal remains unchanged: total Ukrainian defeat. But he's only managed to take a sliver of Ukrainian territory at the cost of hundreds of thousands of casualties. At this rate, it would take more than a century for him to conquer Ukraine. Trump's gambit may offer Putin relief, but Ukraine is not yet at the breaking point where it would be forced to accept Trump's deal, ceding land to Russia and mineral wealth to the U.S. And that's where our guests come in. They'll unpack these critical developments and what they mean for Ukraine, Russia, and the world. Let's get started.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to our speakers and to all of you in the audience. This is our webinar on Ukraine's fight for self-determination and 3 years of resistance against Russian imperialism. I'm Susie Wiseman, and I will be your moderator during this webinar, sponsored by the Ukraine Solidarity Network in the U.S. and hosted by Haymarket Books. I teach Soviet and post-Soviet Russian politics. I've written a political biography of Victor Serge. I broadcast Beneath the Surface and podcast Jacobin Radio. And I'm an editor of Against the Current and Critique. And I'm active with the campaign to free Boris Kagarlitsky and all political prisoners, among other things. Today, we're marking the third anniversary of Putin and the Kremlin's reckless invasion of Ukraine. 1,095 days of unrelenting slaughter and destruction in a war that has changed the trajectory of the 21st century. Too much of the international left has responded badly to this war, seeing the US and NATO as responsible, absolving Putin and leaving Ukraine out of the discussion. We salute the fierce resistance of Ukraine and thank leftists like Taras Bilis and our speaker, Denis Pilash, who have explained to the international left why they should stand in solidarity with Ukraine in their fight against the Kremlin now more than ever. And now that the Trump administration is engaged in so-called peace talks with Russia, excluding Ukraine entirely, global politics have taken a stunning turn, raising the geopolitical stakes to new heights. As Trump embraces Putin's revisionist narrative, outrageously claiming Ukraine started the war and that Zelensky is a dictator, Ukraine finds itself not only fighting Russian imperial aggression, but facing an historical betrayal by its most powerful ally. Even worse, Trump has demanded control over Ukraine's critical minerals or rare earths in exchange for peace, a $500 million payback that includes everything from ports and infrastructure to oil and gas. The terms presented to Zelensky amount to the U.S. economic colonization of Ukraine in legal perpetuity, as they impose a burden of reparations that cannot possibly be paid. Zelensky has refused this so-called deal, demanding that there will be no negotiations without Ukraine and Europe at the table. He even went so far as to offer to resign in exchange for peace and NATO protection. If only we could imagine the same threat to resign from either Trump or Putin. What does this mean for Ukraine's survival, Europe's stability, Russia's future, and the broader left struggle against imperialism, authoritarianism, and incipient fascism? We're here to unpack this rapidly shifting landscape with the help of three incisive analysts and activists, one from Ukraine, one from Russia, and the third from the U.S. Our speakers today, in order, are Denis Pilash, Grusha Golayeva, and Howie Hawkins. We're going to begin with Denis Pilash. He's a political scientist at Kyiv National University and an activist with the Ukrainian Democratic Socialist Organization, Social Movement, Socialny Rukh. He's on the editorial board of Commons, Journal of Social Criticism. One of his articles, co-authored with Denis Gorbach, is entitled, "We Need a People Solidarity with Ukraine and Against War, Not the Fake Solidarity of Governments." Denis will speak about the general situation in Ukraine and the squeeze they now find themselves in, thanks to Trump's betrayal. And after Denis finishes, I will then introduce our next speakers, and then we're going to open it up to the audience. So with that, Denis Pilash, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So, comrades, friends, 3 years ago, on this very day, Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities awoke to the thunder of Russian missiles. So 8 years after unleashing hostilities with the occupation of Crimea, Russia started a full-scale imperialist war of choice. And we remember that chilling dawn of February 2022, exactly the same time when Nazi planes were attacking the same cities back in 1941. And once again, an empire sought to erase our existence, our sovereignty, and any prospect of free and just Ukraine. But they eventually failed with their hopes for a swift invasion. And today we stand here not just as new survivors, but as the people who continue to fight, to live their lives, to rebuild and to dream of Ukraine that is liberated from chains of both foreign tyranny be it full-fledged imperialist or economic neocolonialist power and domestic injustice as well. It should be noted that this Ukrainian defiance, with the working class at the core of the Ukrainian resistance, was assisted by international solidarity, and in many cases this solidarity was quite feasible. So today I also wanted to convey our gratitude to those in the international leftist and labor movement who stood in solidarity and who continue to do this, and our thanks from our organization, social movement, and from our comrades in the unions, miners, construction, transportation, healthcare workers, like the latter have their movement be like Nina, also from individual militant unionists like Yuri Samoilov in Kryvyi Rih and Alexander Skiba from the Free Railway Workers Union. And he asked me to thank you for your successful fundraiser that actually helped to purchase generators, because they are literally saving lives. Just there was a story about an elderly grandma, and one of these generators was quite helpful, because Russia never ceased attacking Ukrainian civilian infrastructure. It never ceased attacking Ukrainian energy infrastructure, power stations, energy grids. They often speak of peace negotiations, but it was never about proper talks on their side. It was always about forcing Ukraine to unconditional surrender. Now we see that they do no goodwill gestures, yes, to show. They instead are doubling down their attacks with drones, with the missiles on Ukrainian cities. And again, we can say that this was doubled down since Donald Trump was elected, because with his return to the White House, well, it was made clear that Russia's Putin's impunity is directly fueling the rise of fascist forces in other countries and vice versa. So now we see that the most reactionary circles of the ruling class, they feel empowered by Putin, Trump, and their colluding. This unholy alliance of Putin's and global far-right neo-fascism, Trumpist reaction, Muskian oligarchy, it seeks to reshape the world into this playground for the ultra-rich, ultra-authoritarian. So now you can see this multipolarity in action, the multipolarity that Kremlin was talking a lot. It's not about making the world order more democratic or equal. It's about carving the world into spheres of influence of a handful of powers with the worst of imperial ambitions. Now their goal is for Ukraine to be left squashed by Putin, while Trump can turn to his ridiculous expansionism in the Western Hemisphere, unleashing hell on, I don't know, Greenlanders, Mexicans, Cubans, other Latin Americans. So while Ukraine isn't even allowed to the table where its future is decided, so these forces of global reaction, they do not simply conspire, you know, like in some smoke-filled rooms. They act actually in broad daylight. They are just blatantly sabotaging international support, treating Ukraine's fate as just a bargaining chip in their power games and their appetites. So just in the news, yes, we had this information about the resolution in the UN General Assembly that was just voted, advancing a comprehensive peace in Ukraine. It was drafted by Ukraine and more than 50 co-sponsors. So it still was voted by the majority of the UN members, but the US voted against, together with Russia, Israel, North Korea, Orbán's Hungary, a couple of military juntas. So this seems like the, I don't know, the biggest crossover of Marvel villains. Not even to speak about these horrendous claims that are made by the billionaire president on a daily basis. How even fact check a person whose every single statement, every digit he comes up with, is just a made up lie. So the worst of everything is, of course, this mentioned so-called deal that is essentially a blackmail on rare earth minerals. But you can say that it's about the entirety of Ukrainian resources and infrastructure. So the terms of this so-called deal are reported to be worse than reparations that were imposed on losing German side in World War One. This just opens Ukraine for looting by US capital in the future, but also it's forcing retroactive payment on Ukraine, because they expect everyone bowing down without any objection. So even the still very servile approach of Zelensky's government, it infuriates them, because they can't stand any sort of, you know, like subjectivity, agency. And also what comes with their deals is this hyper-capitalist vision So now we have the richest capitalist in the world who is literally destroying the social security, public education, healthcare, and this is a template to be replicated throughout the world. So if they succeed, we are getting to even worse hell. And in Ukraine as well, because even more deregulation, even more anti-labor legislation to appease the US investors. So now we also see that uber capitalist goblins like Musk and J.D. Vance, they declared war on democracies in Europe and worldwide, and also try to install far-right, ultra-conservative, Quisling-style governments everywhere. So we see that our class enemies, oligarchs and dictators, are united. So we should unite too. Because the moment to act and resist is just now. So far, it seems that the resistance, both internally in the U.S. and internationally, is still atomized, scarce, and we need to really build this network of solidarity, not just with Ukraine, but with the entirety of the oppressed people throughout the world, and to raise this fight to a new level, because essentially this may actually lead us not just to betraying Ukraine, but essentially to losing any prospects for progressive development throughout the world.
Thank you very much, Dennis. So we're going to move now. The second speaker is Grusha Galayeva, and she is in exile from Russia. She's the managing editor of the Russian socialist and anti-war website Posly Media. Posly means after in Russian, and for Posly Media, it has a double meaning. It means it began after the Russian invasion, but the word also signifies after, as in what's next. Grusha is the author of many articles, including Navalny and Us and Did Lenin Create Ukraine on the Right of Self-Determination and Marxism. Grusha is going to talk about the internal situation in Russia, explain why Putin is interested in a respite, but only on his terms. And then she's going to say some words about the liberal opposition and the left. Grusha, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Susie, for the introduction. Thanks the organizers for this event. It is very important for us to keep remembering the 24th of February as the tragic date that we have to remind the world about. And I also thank Dennis for his intervention, and I completely second him on his international analysis and of what the turn of the US towards Russia means globally. I think that is very important. And I will now focus a little bit on the situation in Russia itself. So as for the internal situation and the Russian position in this negotiation, it is important to mention that sanctions are now taking their toll on the Russian economy. Budget cuts were made for social spending. Now it's 5 times less than before. At the same time, there is an increase in the war-related budget. It now makes up to 70% of the total spending. Oil share in the budget revenue dropped, and the share of taxes paid by the population increased. The inflation rate is officially estimated at 10%, but in reality, it's about 20%. So that means that the Russian population is beginning to increasingly feel the toll of the war. As for the military, Russia seems to need a break, but still it can go on till the end of the year as at the same pace as many experts estimate. For example, according to the International Institute for Strategic Studies, as of the beginning of January 2025, at least 172,000 Russian servicemen have been killed and 611,000 wounded. So that means that the irrecoverable losses for the Russian army amounted to about 550,000 soldiers and officers who will never be able to fight again. And that is approximately half of the total number of personnel by the start of the full-scale invasion in February 2022. Also, we can see that there are about 30,000 soldiers drawn into the Russian army for every month. And that means that Russia can't conduct active combat operation and even support the offensive for at least 1 year in the parts of the front. And yet it has increasing problems with the stockpiles of weapons because they have been depleted, especially tanks and armored vehicles are in shortage. Then Russia manages to replenish its losses by fixing the broken artillery and building 25 tanks a month. Yet now Russia uses old models built in the 60s and 70s, and eventually it will run out of those. So for a year, at least, Russia is able to continue the war without any ceasefire. So even though economically and militarily Putin is interested in a respite, it does not have to happen right now. What he really needs is to have the West got its military support for Ukraine. And with the rift between Trump and Zelensky, we see that support is now put into question. Europe also demonstrated that without the US, it is not ready to do more to defend Ukraine. We have not seen that Putin is ready to make any concessions. He sees the east of Ukraine as effectively Russian territory. Unless the West comes up with a common strategy for supporting Ukraine and repelling Putin's advance, Putin will not feel compelled to continue with the ceasefire deal if any conditions he does not like are put forward. And I think this is extremely important to understand for our comrades in the West. In either case, be it a ceasefire or a continuation of the war, the level of political repression in Russia is bound to increase. And I think that is especially important for both the West and the global South, because Russia can be held as an authoritarian mirror to the rest of the world, because that is what the multipolar world will look like for the majority of the population. Right now, there are 3,000 political cases in Russia. 1,500 people are in prison. Persecutions continue throughout the year. The patterns from previous years remained unchanged. So they are direct targeting of individuals, persecution of vulnerable groups, and the adoption of repressive laws. Moreover, another horrifying trend of the year was the death of individuals imprisoned for political motives. Alexei Navalny was murdered. 4 other people died in custody. Another 2 passed away as a result of the consequences of being held in a punishment cell. And 1 died as a result of detention. One of the turning points of political repression in Russia this year was the Baymak case in Bashkortostan, which affected dozens of people. Another significant turning point was the Ankara prisoner exchange between Russia and the West, in which Russia released 16 people, most of them political prisoners. We also witnessed a sharp increase in criminal prosecutions of foreign agents and an intensification of the persecution of LGBTQ plus people. Political repression in Russia needs broader international attention. Only this attention and pressure can put a limit to how far Putin can go. And now a few words about the Russian opposition. The Russian liberal opposition is in crisis, especially after the death of Alexei Navalny 1 year ago. It has been going through a leadership crisis, and now with Trump, through an identity crisis. But this crisis could enable the liberal opposition to finally come up with a way to address the 2 main reasons which made Putin's invasion possible. The first one is lack of democratic institutions. And the second one is the impoverishment and indebtedness of the Russian population. Both of these were not seen as a problem by Russian economic liberals in the 1990s, but the war signaled a shift in common sense. The challenge before the left today is to fill in the ideological vacuum that the opposition is facing. The common challenge is to stay relevant and in contact with activists and people who do not support the war and who are in Russia. So that will be it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We have a super disciplined group here. So we're going to move then to our final speaker, and then we're going to open it up. I guess first we'll just do questions among ourselves, and then we're going to open it up to the audience. Our third speaker is Howie Hawkins. He is a retired Teamster in Syracuse, New York, and a member of the Green Party and Solidarity and the Ukraine Solidarity Network. He was the Green Party's presidential candidate in 2020. And in 2024, He visited both Georgia and Ukraine. So Howie's here to talk about the conversations and discussions and anecdotes from his recent visit to Ukraine. And he's going to relate what Ukrainian progressives, including socialists, Greens, trade unionists, environmentalists, feminist students, and others want from the Western and international left, and what they want the international left to understand, and what kind of solidarity we should be building. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Howie Hawkins.
Thank you, Susie. So I went to Ukraine really at the urging of Ukrainians that we've been working with since the full-scale invasion. And I went to express my solidarity and also to hear and amplify back in the U.S. their views on what is going on, because Ukrainians are too often left out of the debates about U.S. policy on Ukraine, particularly on parts of the U.S. left. So I was hosted by the social movement, or Sotsiyonny Rukh. They housed me, they fed me, they arranged meetings, they did a great job. Dennis, who's here, provided a room for me my first week there, where the reality of the war really came home to me with the frequent air raid warnings. And then on the second day I was there, I heard this loud explosion in the distance, and it was probably the missile that struck Taras Shevchenko National University, where Dennis teaches. So Dennis had to take his classes online the rest of the week, and he spent a day up there helping to clean up the rubble. So social movement folks arranged meetings for me with their members in Kyiv and Kryvyi Rih and Lviv. They set up meetings with leaders of the miners, construction workers, an atomic workers union, which I'm a longtime anti-nuclear activist, but there are 10 nuclear workers from Zaporizhia that are missing, probably in Russian custody. And so that was what that meeting was about. I had meetings with feminists and veterans and students in the left-wing student union, Direct Action or Priyamadiya. And they brought me the first day I was there to a meeting of left-wing members of the European Parliament in the newly formed European Left Alliance for the People in the Planet. And it was refreshing, given all the debates we've had with campus in the U.S., to see these left-wing members of the European Parliament talking about how to strengthen their country's military support for Ukraine. And then on diplomatic support, they focused on targeting Russia's shadow fleet that carries oil and gas exports in violation of sanctions. And so I got to speak with a class of high school students who have to meet every day in the basement of their school in Kryvyi Rih because of the constant bombardments. And then one morning I heard a big explosion in Kryvyi Rih from a missile strike on a residential apartment block. And that bombing killed 4, a mother and 3 children, and injured 14 others. And I was supposed to be actually near that building because Yuri Samoylov, who's the head of the Independent Miners Union of Ukraine, wanted to show me the balcony where Nestor Makhno, the leader of the anarchist communist movement during the Russian Revolution and Civil War, had given speeches. But the balcony, because it was near the building, was cordoned off by the emergency responders. So Yuri took me instead to the open pit iron ore mines. There are also underground mines and the slag heaps where he had worked for 35 years. And it's a barren reddish landscape. So Yuri joked that Ukrainian miners had got to Mars before Musk had. He also talked about the environmental problems of mining and how he believed that if it was under public ownership and workers' control, the mining could be done in an environmentally sustainable way. I also had the opportunity to meet with some other contacts I already had in Ukraine with the Green Party there, and also with Svetlana Romanko, who's an internationally known climate activist whose organization, Razum We Stand, is working to strengthen fossil fuel sanctions on Russia and reconstruct Ukraine on the basis of clean, renewable energy. And the consistent message I got from all these progressives, socialists, greens, trade unionists, environmentalists, veterans, feminists, students, they want us to know that what we say and do in the U.S. and the West matters. The international left's moral political support for their struggles against Russian tanks and Western banks. And that's how I phrased it first, because I'd heard it that way. But Yuri Samoylov said, don't forget the Russian oligarchs. That's the third front we're fighting. When the public in Ukraine hears Western leftists, you know, supporting or at least excusing Russia's invasion, they don't want anything to do with the left, which makes it harder for progressive forces in Ukraine. So that was one of the messages they want to get. And there's so many stories I could relate, but I'll close with two. One is I met with this guy named Dima from Donetsk, and I met him on a train ride from Kyiv to Lviv, where he was going to continue on to the far western city of Uzhhorod to referee a football or soccer game. And he recounted how he was a municipal court worker in Donetsk City. And in 2014, the Russians came in and just seized the building, seized the government. And he had to flee to exile, first to Dnipro and now Kyiv, where he's still a municipal court worker. His father, who was a police officer, had to get the hell out. First, he went to Mariupol, but he had to go from there after the full-scale invasion in 2022, when Russia just flattened Mariupol like Israel's flattened Gaza, and he's now moved to Dnipro. Meanwhile, his mother stayed in Donetsk City because the family knew that the Ukrainians don't bomb residential areas, so she could keep watch over the family home. You know, what he wanted us to know is that his family and many families from the occupied territories really want Western support to help push Russia out of Ukraine so they can go back to their home communities and their families can be reunited. And the second story is about how the Green Party in Ukraine, when I talked to them, they had the same appeal to the European Greens that Taras Bilis has had to the Western left generally. And that is that we need to do more than just protest Russia's aggression. We need to take the lead as Greens, as the left, in advancing a positive program for reforming and rebuilding international law and institutions so that they can actually enforce international laws to protect human rights and smaller nations from aggression. And Taras, as many of you know, got the Daniel Singer Prize for one of his essays on that subject. And as many of you also know, he serves in the Ukrainian armed forces, working with reconnaissance drones. And I'm told that he was wounded last month, fixing an antenna outside his bunker. He got shrapnel in his legs. He should fully recover. And I know we all wish him a full recovery. So I got the opportunity to talk with Taras in Kyiv. And it was right after Trump got elected. And he was very discouraged. He saw it as a huge victory for the far right globally, the pro-Putin far right. And as I think was mentioned today, the U.S. voted with Russia, Belarus, North Korea, and others against a U.N. General Assembly resolution condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And what Taras told me is he said, you know, he had been hoping that Russia's naked aggression would get the left in the West to take the lead in reforming the international system to protect human rights in smaller nations. And after Trump's election, he said now he's afraid it would take decades. So one question I had for Taras, which I know a number of us in the U.S. had after he spoke about the Daniel Singer Prize at the Socialism 2024 conference last September, at the very end, and there was no opportunity to follow up, he said the U.S. left shouldn't try to lobby Biden about Ukraine policy. And like, I got an opportunity to say, ask him, you know, well, what was he talking about there? And he told me he was concerned that it would be too divisive for the U.S. left and that we should work together on the things we agree on. He said the social movement had to do that, set aside some of their differences on the Russian question while the Minsk Accords were in effect between 2015 and 2022, and build themselves around other issues. And of course, when Russia's full-scale invasion happened, it was clear how everybody stood. They had to resist the Russian invaders. And what struck me about Taras's answer was, here's this guy in Ukraine engaged in the armed struggle against the Russian invaders, and he's concerned about how we build unity on the U.S. left, to the point of suggesting we should maybe set aside the question of Ukraine. And I think that shows the depth of Taras Bilis's internationalist commitments. I don't think he was right that we should sweep these divisions between campus and internationalists under the rug. I think it's an unavoidable question now, especially with Trump in office, and as we see aligning with Russia on Ukraine and Europe generally. And just from a practical organizing point of view, the campus position is now aligned with the MAGA Republicans on Ukraine. And that position alienates the left from the overwhelming majority of progressive-minded Americans who support Ukraine. That's clear from repeated public opinion polls right up to this day. So if the progressive forces in Ukraine want us to know that our moral, political, and material support matters to them, I would also say, and that was what they wanted me to tell you, I would also say that such solidarity from the U.S. left for the Ukrainian left also matters for the prospects of the left in the U.S.
Thank you, Howie. What you've done is actually helped pose some of the questions that we should take up in this next period, which is our discussion among ourselves. I have lots of questions, but if either Howie or Grusha or Dennis wants to bring in questions for the other speakers, please feel free to do so. Perhaps I just wanted to start with Dennis and ask, what are the potential consequences of the attempt to pressure Ukraine into these really unfavorable settlement? As we know, Putin's war aims remain unchanged, and any deal signed obviously is only going to invite further aggression. At least that's how I see it. So I'd like to hear from you how the Ukrainian left is responding and how you see, you know, how you see this terrible turn of events and this huge betrayal.
So in general, not just the Ukrainian left, but Ukrainian society, they obviously perceive any steps, and this means virtually all the steps that have been taken by Trump administration into the footsteps of Chamberlain back in Munich in 1938 of appeasing the aggressor and actually siding up with the aggressor. Almost nothing on the table was even, they didn't even try to create some visibility, some fake, but still that they could sell some sort of guarantees. No, they don't even speak about any security guarantees for Ukraine or any gains for Ukraine. Everything is in this vague Trumpian manner. Maybe it will be Russian, maybe it wouldn't be. And ultimately, yes, this means that Ukraine has to prepare not just to be abandoned by the US, but to have a plan B, possibly C, etc. How to withstand with the open hostility of Washington. And this means mobilizing forces that still support Ukraine inside Europe and beyond Europe. Much more should be done on the Ukrainian side to bring in the global south, but this is a big challenge, actually, yes. And we at Commons Journal, we have been running for now a couple of years the project called Dialogue of the Peripheries, in order to bring together people from Ukraine and broader Central Eastern European context with people with the so-called Global South. We know it's a problematic term, but still, like, denoting regions from Latin America to Asia. And actually learning more about our different, but still in some ways similar backgrounds. Yes, so different forms of colonial and imperialist aggression throughout history were imposed in different regions, but this essentially has to bring us to a common table against the global so-called great powers, because what's now espoused by Putin and Trump is directly this collusion, a direct deal made by the most powerful ones, or those who think of them as such. Not just Ukraine is excluded. Even Europeans are denied to get a place at this table. And it's really funny to observe how you have these so-called talks in Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy, with dismembering journalists in its embassies. And then you have two leaders of their respective regimes, one that is running completely sham elections, as it was outlined in a recent intervention by Bernie Sanders. Yes, so Putin, who is a parody on any sort of electoral process. And then you have a guy who tried to overthrow the elections, who from day one started usurping as much power as he can grab, and his ultra-capitalist cronies. And these guys are now, you know, like lecturing Ukraine how it has to get elections as soon as possible. In order to have elections, you don't have to see missiles and planes flying over your head. Yes. So ultimately, this means very tough times for us. But it also, you know, like this last stage of proceeding this information, it's It means that, okay, now we are against like the most powerful forces in the world, but it may bring a very small but still opening for those in the world who disregarded the Russian invasion to Ukraine as something not so important, as done not by the major imperialist power, because now you have the major imperialist power on the side of this smaller imperialist power. And both of them are going for this revisionist take on global international relations in order to return to sort of old school colonialism from the 19th century. So this is so blatantly clear where you have like the direct, it's so distilled. You have the most cynical billionaires in the world, like colluding with one of the like most shady dictators in the world. But ultimately, this means that now the fate of Ukraine is very directly linked to the fate of the global struggles against the rise of the far right and authoritarian trends embodied by Trump, Putin, Bolsonaro, Modi, Milei, Erdogan, Orban, and you can continue all this stuff.
Thank you for that. I have a further question, and I'll invite others to come in too. But just on this, you know, one of the things that you stressed, and Howie sort of says that Ukrainians he met also stressed, was the need to overcome differences and unite together in this really important struggle. And this is very difficult, of course. The left has been isolated and made irrelevant everywhere. I would say, you know, we're facing huge defeats and setbacks worldwide, but it doesn't mean that the left is defeated. There's a tremendous amount of left sentiment, but there's not a lot of effective left organization. That's something that we'll have to have in the future. But I was going to ask some of the ways that in Ukraine that, for example, workers and left movements had to, let's say, change their ideas about NATO. Do you see that, you know, NATO membership will offer you protection? Do you see it as a kind of double-edged sword? Is this something that you discuss because you need to have international protection against Putin? This is a, you know, a difficult question, but I kind of want to know how you in Ukraine have been able to unite differences. I know that Socialny Ruch changed a lot in these years in terms of, I read somewhere, overcoming previous sectarian differences that weren't important in order to unite in the main struggle, which is the struggle for survival of Ukraine and survival of all of you. I also want to know, and Grusha can probably be part of this, whether or not you're in discussion with Russian leftists who also oppose what their government is doing, and if you see any sort of collaboration possible, or is it just too difficult?
Yeah, so about our situation, I guess the major adjustment we had to do was the same as for the entirety of the Ukrainian population. So it was how to reorient your work in times of war, martial law, and the necessity to be efficient in providing assistance for those who suffering, who are suffering due to the hostilities. So starting from those people who are residing near the war-torn regions, to those who had to relocate, become internally displaced persons or refugees abroad. And it also means how to support those of our comrades who joined the armed resistance. And essentially, this also meant that we still have to continue our previous work, but we have to reshape it in a way that suits the current situation. For instance, in times of war and martial law, you have much less space for public protests. And we were oriented on, you know, like state protest organization, on organizing and bringing people to the streets and squares. So still, there are pockets of resistance in many cases from the student union that was mentioned today, direct action, and lots of spontaneous protests in the universities that are caused either by some local injustice or by the general structural policy of Ukrainian education ministry that is one of the most neoliberal. Yes, so it's run by people who essentially, I think, would agree with a sort of Trumpian, Muskian vision that we need to get rid of public education and privatize it or make it fully on this grant-based schemes. And then you have different other protests, mostly against spontaneous, from wage arrears to preserving some of the public green social spaces, because even in times of war, or we can say, given like Naomi Klein's famous shock doctrine, that especially in times of war, our own oligarchy capital is using the situation to profit as much as they can to continue their development business. Some of these guys were also clearly inspired by Donald Trump in their life road. But at the same time, you need to find ways how to convey people's protest and people's anger in different ways. So this means intensifying the work in the courts, because due to the number of anti-labor legislation that was pushed through, again, given the opportunity our ruling class grabbed it, back in spring 2022. So it made easier for the employers to fire workers and to worsen their work conditions. But ultimately, this means that more and more employees are going to the courts, and sometimes, or even not so sometimes, we have a number of very prominent in their sectors, very prominent victories on the side of working people, members of the unions. But still, we need a more systematic solution. So this gives us another challenge, yes, how to reformulate, reshape our program, our platform for the times of war and wartime and post-war reconstruction. Yes, so we were trying again to gather those movements that are linked to all the struggles to have a common vision that would be anti-capitalist, anti-oligarchic in this way. And then you have these big questions of international security, yes? And obviously, I'm still very critical, of course, NATO and U.S. imperialism. I was politicized on the wake of Bush administration starting the Iraq war. And that's why I clearly see how Putin is a continuation of Bush adventurism, military adventurism, not some sort of, you know, like dialectic negation. But for the Ukrainian society, for the society, for instance, in the Nordic states, Sweden and Finland, Putin has been the most efficient NATO salesman. Yes, because given the fact of this outright aggression, it has led to skyrocketing approval of joining NATO as possibly the most visible military alliance. So at the same time, we were also speaking from the beginning that NATO means different things in different contexts. Yes, for the US, at least until Trump's administration, NATO was a way to clearly have Europe under sort of its control. But for Europe, it was also a way to reduce its military spending for the Western Europe. But for Eastern, Central Eastern Europe, many of them, both the elites and also the population, they saw a prospect of a possible Russian revanchist interventions. So they resorted to this membership in order to find some protection. And this is what happened with the Ukrainian population. But at the same time, in the wake of this, in the course of the full-scale invasion, many people who grew enthusiastic about Ukraine someday becoming part of NATO umbrella, they also now are frustrated by the lack of both the prospects for Ukraine to join either NATO or any other security guarantees, and also the inability of these alliances to clearly support Ukraine. Yes, so notwithstanding with all the talks of how everything is just purely NATO's fault, but you've seen that major NATO members from the beginning, they never were going to admit Ukraine to be a NATO member. So it was never a real prospect, yes. But at the same time, yes, it captured the attention of the audience, and still it's now part of this bargaining. Yes, what we can abandon for anything. And the worst prospect is essentially being forced to a sort of capitulation, but at the same time leaving Ukraine open for another Russian intervention. So this is what we the Ukrainian society in the broader European context want to avoid. Obviously, this means that you need to do this concrete analysis of every case, every situation. You cannot every time resort to very simple schemes. Like the same also goes for a worldview where you see many perceived here, at least for a time, that while Russia is so clearly vile and evil, so everything that is deemed as anti-Russian should be good for Ukraine. Yes, but it's the same trap that sort of this one-sided anti-Americanism produces. Yes, when you just ignore that you have not just one bad guy in the room. You have the general, the problem is in the imperialist capitalist construction that gives these countries and their capital so much power. Yeah, so ultimately, yes, we are still engaged in lots of discussions and lots of, you know, trying not just to make these programmatic points, but to be in a dialogue with both comrades abroad and with the Ukrainian society as well. But ultimately, yes, this leads to think outside the box. So just this simple campus decisions, be it anti-Western or pro-Western, now they failed. Both of them failed.
Thank you for that. Let's open it up then between Howie and Dennis to just kind of round out the discussion in talking about practical solidarity and what we can do. And also, I guess it's hard to say what you're going to do next in Ukraine, I suppose, because you're watching this unfolding betrayal and reacting to it, I suppose. So maybe we could get a couple of thoughts. Either one of you can start. I'll leave it open.
I'd like Dennis to wrap up because he's been so sharp. I just wanted to add one little thing about the question about the right. You know, those of us in the U.S. need to worry about the right here. Trump got nearly 50% of the vote and he's in power. You look across Europe and, you know, the AFD neo-Nazis in Germany got nearly 20% yesterday. National Rally in France is threatening power. Nigel Farage's, whatever his name is, the right-wing party in the UK is rising. The right is part of governments in Austria, Netherlands. But in Ukraine, where they had elections in 2019, the far-right parties, you know, the right sector, Sloboda and others, they ran a president who got 1.56% of the vote. And they had a parliamentary slate that got 1.65 for president and 2.16% for parliament, below the 5% threshold, so they didn't get in. So Ukraine does have a right. It's a problem. But man, you know, in the West, we got much bigger problems.
Okay,
then the thing I'll say about going forward is I just invite people to be in touch with the Ukraine Solidarity Network. Go online, ukrainesolidaritynetwork.us. And there's a lot of material there, including, you know, stuff that the Ukrainians have written on our website. And get involved in, you know, let's bring this issue to the whole movement against Trump reaction.
Thank you. And Dennis, if you could just sort of wrap up with these thoughts, we have about 3 minutes.
Okay, so I also feel like here in Ukraine, we have lots of challenges to tackle with, and the right wing is one of them. Corruption is another one. Austerity. But I feel that it's not up to Americans to taunt Ukrainians that they have problems, because now the major problem in the world, I think, in all three of these issues, it stems from the U.S. So it's the most manifested problems of the current stage of capitalist development. So ultimately, yes, we see how everything is now interconnected and how a possible outcome, how Putin's invasion, it essentially made easier for other aggressors to also try to do their military adventures. We see how Trump's election, it also stimulates different far-right reactionary forces throughout the world to also try to get into the power by different means. Yes, now we understand that Ukraine isn't the only suffering country in the world. We aren't the only suffering people, but we would like to convey our solidarity to all others, and we would like also to feel the solidarity of the people throughout the world, because here we fight for a peace that is not dictated by those who would sacrifice us for their own comfort. We want a Ukraine that is free, not just from Russian tanks, Russian goods, yes, but also from this international banks, economic colonization by Western corporations, oligarchy control of our own ruling class. And we aren't going to surrender, not to the invader, not to the profiteers, not to those cowards who seek compromise at the cost of justice. So ultimately, we would like others in the world to pick up their fights and to essentially combine their blows against the most reactionary forces in power that are now rising, and they're now coming together to a sort of a new black international of far-right neo-fascists, authoritarians, dictators. Yes, so they want to adjust the current oligarchic capitalism to morph it into something even more terrible, even more oppressive, while our alternative, that is a direct opposite, the democratic socialist alternative, has to be unfolded. Yes, so I hope that those on the left who are true internationalists, they will join their forces throughout the world. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank all of you and thank the Ukraine Solidarity Network in the United States and Haymarket Books for making this possible, and Sean Larson for his technical expertise. And I'm Susie Wiseman. I want to thank Dennis Pilash, Grusha Gilaeva, Howie Hawkins, and just say, inform yourselves. You can find out about repression in Russia by looking at ovd.info-info. You can go on to any one of the Solidarity Network here to get more information, and read comments, read the Ukrainian press, educate yourself more about Ukraine. I know those of you who are with us today probably do, but the tasks in front of us are immense, and the stakes are even more immense. So I'm an optimist in the world. I think that this right-wing craze cannot prevail for long, but we have a huge fight in front of us, and I want to thank all of you for doing what you can.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Dennis Pilash, Grusha Gilaeva, and Howie Hawkins. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osman Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click the archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio, for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
Works airs here on KPFK every Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. Coming up tonight.
During World War II, a number of Japanese Americans were sent to relocation camps and prison. Upon their release, they became outcasts.
What happens if I decide that I'm not Japanese after all, that I'm an American?
I will die.
No-No Boy by Ken Narasaki, adapted from the novel by John Okada. Next time on LA Theater Works.
That's LA Theater Works, coming up here on KPFK tonight at 10 p.m.
Support comes from UCLA Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Orquesta Acocan on Saturday, March 29th at the United Theater on Broadway. The ensemble features a carefully curated selection of Havana's finest musicians, polishing Cuban mambo's golden sound with a contemporary sheen. More information at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
K.
KPFK, your progressive media outlet, is listener-supported commercial-free radio. But did you know you don't have to wait for the station fund drives to support your favorite radio station? You can donate online at any time. Visit kpfk.org. That's kpfk.org. And we thank you for your support.